The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the double July-August 2020 issue. We continue with our cover story, Everything Worth Knowing, Our Bodies. Titans of Immunity. Why do some people get sick all the time while others stay in freakishly good health? For years, Melanie Musson's friends have marveled at her superpower, staying healthy no matter what germs are making the rounds. Colds and flu felled plenty of Musson's dorm mates in college, but the viruses always seemed to pass her by. I never got sick once, she says. I got about 5 hours of sleep a night. I finished school in 3 years, and I worked 30 hours a week throughout. My best friends labeled me the machine. Musson's ironclad immune system also set her apart at her first job. While she was working at an assisted living facility, her coworkers succumbed to a stomach virus that was running rampant. Undaunted, Musson offered to cover their shifts. There I was, the brand new employee, getting as much overtime as I wanted. I wasn't worried that I would catch the virus because it just doesn't happen. While the rest of us battle seasonal flu, chronic allergies, and back-to-back wintertime colds, Musson and other immune masters glide through with scarcely a sniffle, something University of Pittsburgh immunologist John Mellers sees all the time. People get exposed to the same virus, the same dose, even the same source. One gets very sick and the other doesn't. It's only natural to wonder, why do some people always seem to fall on the right side of this equation? And could our own immune systems approach the same level with the right tune-up? Doctors have noted natural variations in the immune response among people since Hippocrates' time, but the reason has remained elusive for centuries. New research, however, is starting to illustrate just how your genes, habits, and past disease exposures affect the character and strength of your immune response. These discoveries are helping to define the parameters of a race in which people like Musson have a head start and others have much more ground to cover. The moment a virus, bacterium, or other invader breaches your cell's walls, your body rolls out a tightly choreographed defense strategy. The main architects of this process are a set of human leukocyte antigen genes, or HLA genes, which code for molecules that fine-tune the body's immune response. So when a bacterium gets into one of your cells, your HLA genes churn out proteins that flag the cell as infected so that specialized immune cells will swarm in to destroy it. Other HLA genes activate cells that rein in the immune response so it doesn't destroy more than is necessary. Like fingerprints, everyone's HLA gene assortment is unique. Your HLA genes give you a broad repertoire of immune defense tactics, but that repertoire may be great for some microorganisms and lousy for others, Meller says. It's not like there's one HLA type that's highly immune to everything. This genetic variation helps explain why you might catch every cold virus going around, but you haven't gotten a stomach bug in decades. A Massachusetts General Hospital study found that some so-called HIV controllers, immune stalwarts who don't develop AIDS from the virus HIV, have HLA gene variants that prompt specialized cells to swarm in and attack proteins key to the virus's function. But your HLA genes aren't the only ones that shape your immune resistance. The Human Genome Project has identified tens of thousands of gene variants that are more common in people who develop specific diseases and less common in people without these conditions. Flagging these kinds of gene disease links is a relatively simple matter, says immunologist Pandurangan Vijayanand of the Lahala Institute for Immunology. After researchers identify a gene sequence that's linked to a disease, however, they need to figure out what it's actually doing, says Vijayanand. How is this change in the sequence impacting the cell or causing the susceptibility to disease? To answer this question, Vijayanand and his team are creating what they call an atlas to catalog which proteins each gene produces and how these proteins change the function of different cell types. For example, he has identified a gene variant that makes people more prone to asthma, a condition in which the body attacks its own healthy airway cells by driving high production of proteins that rev up the immune response. Other gene variants appear to help people fight lung tumors by prompting their tissues to produce more T lymphocytes, specialized immune shock troops that kill cancer cells. While a dizzying number of genetic differences remain to be cataloged, immunologists agree that, in general, these differences help explain why resistance to some pathogens can seem to run in families. People like Melanie Musson probably get a genetic leg up to some degree. Musson says her mother, father, and siblings rarely get sick. Conversely, or unfairly, you might instead inherit a tendency to develop diabetes, recurrent strep infections, or autoimmune diseases. However anemic or hardy your innate immune arsenal, it supplies only the broad contours of your body's resistance to threats. Environmental influences fill in the details, from where you live, to your sleeping patterns, to your history of previous infections. In a 2015 cell study, researchers studied more than 100 pairs of identical twins and how their immune systems responded to the flu shot. About three-quarters of the differences they saw were driven by environmental factors rather than genetic ones. The differences in twins' immune systems also grew more pronounced the older they got, suggesting that outside influences continue to shape our immune potential over time. Some of these influences show up in early childhood and may be hard to offset later on. Researchers have long known that children who live on farms are less likely to develop autoimmune diseases like asthma and allergies. An Ohio State University study from July 2019 hints at one reason why. Farm kids have a more diverse array of gut microbes than city kids, and the presence of some of these gut microbes predicts lower frequencies of immune cells that create allergic inflammation. Broad microbial exposure, in short, appears to train the immune system not to overreact to substances like animal dander. But regardless of where you grew up, if you're unlucky to catch certain disease-causing bugs, they can throw your immunity off balance for years. Cytomegalovirus, a relative of the virus that causes chickenpox, stages its attack by reprogramming the human immune system. Some of the virus's proteins latch onto certain immune cells, interfering with their ability to fight invaders. Other proteins, according to research from the University Medical Center Utrecht, interfere with the expression of key human HLA genes. And since cytomegalovirus infections are chronic, the resulting immune deficits can go on indefinitely. Naturally, you can't control where you're raised or what random pathogens you acquire, but you can control your daily routine, what you put into your body, and how you shield yourself against germs. In recent years, scientists have begun a full-fledged push to find out which lifestyle habits actually foster a robust immune system, and which may be more hype than substance. While the overall picture of how diet shapes immunity is still blurred, new studies do hint at the immune-strengthening effects of certain types of foods. Garlic, for instance, contains a sulfur compound called allicin, which spurs production of disease-fighting immune cells like macrophages and lymphocytes in response to threats. Researchers also report that specific bacteria-containing foods, such as sauerkraut, kimchi, and kefir, produce an immunologically active substance called D-phenylactic acid. This acid appears to signal immune cells, called monocytes, to report for duty by binding to a receptor protein on the cell surfaces. When people eat sauerkraut, very soon afterwards, we see in the blood that there's an increase in the level of this substance, says Leipzig University biologist Claudia Staubert. In future studies, she hopes to clarify exactly how the acid affects monocytes' activity in the body. In addition to tweaking their diets, many titans of immunity embark on intense exercise regimens to keep their health robust. I swim and snorkel year-round in the ocean, up to a mile at a clip, from New England to Miami and a few secluded points in between, says Baron Christopher Hansen, a business consultant who claims he almost never gets sick. But so far, scientific proof that exercise improves immunity is limited. While a new study in rats shows that regular exercise changes the prevalence of different types of immune cells, it isn't clear whether these changes make you less likely to get sick. Getting your daily quota of shut-eye, however, does seem to boost your immunity. Repeated studies show that sleep revs up your immune response, and a recent one from Germany's University of Tübingen reports that it does so in part by preparing disease-fighting T cells to do their jobs more effectively. That's because your body churns out more integrins, proteins that help T cells attach to germ-infected cells and destroy them, while you're asleep. But while getting more sleep could help snap your streak of winter colds, squirting your palms with hand sanitizer may not. In numerous studies, plain old soap and water was shown to kill germs better than sanitizer does. Hand sanitizer is great for alcohol-susceptible bugs, but not all bugs are susceptible, Mellers points out. What's more, using sanitizer won't have any lasting effects on your immunity. The moment you touch another germy surface, your thin layer of protection will vanish. Champions of immunity tend to credit their daily habits with keeping them healthy. But many have also lucked into an ideal balance between effector T cells, the frontline immune soldiers that fend off pathogens, and regulatory T cells, which keep the body's immune arsenal in check, so it won't overrespond to threats. An overactive immune system can be just as troublesome as an underactive one. Autoimmune conditions like rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, and allergies all stem from an immune response that's too forceful and sustained. Last year, scientists at Kyoto University in Japan and elsewhere described one potential way to redress this kind of imbalance, turning effector T cells into regulatory T cells in the lab. Autoimmune episodes are triggered by antigens binding to a receptor on effector T cells, says molecular biologist Shu Narumiya, one of the paper's authors. When Narumiya and his colleagues used an inhibitor chemical to block an enzyme that controls cell development, cells that would normally develop into effector T cells turned into regulatory T cells instead, a tweak that dialed down harmful autoimmune responses in mice. While not everyone needs such an immune fine-tuning, some people could potentially benefit from a treatment based on this technique, Narumiya says. Filling out the ranks of regulatory T cells could someday keep a range of disabling autoimmune conditions under control. Regardless of your T cell balance or your immune track record, there's a hefty dose of serendipity involved in each time your immune system faces a threat. You might consider yourself forever prone to the flu or sniffles, but an X factor, a cross-country move, a dietary tweak, a new therapy, can unexpectedly realign and boost your immune potential. By the same token, no matter how stalwart your HLA gene arsenal, how sound your sleep, or how scrupulous your hygiene, you can expect to end up knocked flat with a nasty bug when you least expect it. Immune health is like a gigantic roulette wheel. You throw the ball down, and where it lands is a matter of chance, Mellers says. You have an encounter with a pathogen, and at the time you get exposed, your front line is not up to snuff. Even titans of immunity can have Achilles heels, and even immune systems that seem licked at the beginning can pull off unlikely victories. When hearts attack, how clogged vessels harm your ticker, and the new ways researchers are coming to the rescue. 911, what's your emergency? The call from dispatch alerts Cleveland EMS to a 57-year-old man with chest pain. The firefighters drop what they're doing while paramedic Kayla DeVore and her partner board the ambulance. The whole team is out of the station in less than a minute. Everything is in place for any emergency they may face, and they arrive on the scene in under 9 minutes. The paramedics are already working as they approach the patient to determine whether he's conscious, whether he's breathing, and how well he can respond to questions. DeVore asks, "Hey, sir, how's it going? When did your symptoms start? What were you doing when the pain started?" As the team continues to get crucial information on the man's condition and history of heart disease, diabetes, and hypertension, they take his vitals. DeVore hooks up an electrocardiogram, or EKG, which tracks the heart's electrical activity. By now, the paramedics have been on the scene for 5 minutes, an eternity in the world of emergency medicine. DeVore scans the markings on the strip of paper scrolling out of the EKG monitor. The patterns change shape during a heart attack, and not all of them signal the same level of emergency. Today, though, she sees the telltale signs of the most serious kind of heart attack. A major coronary artery, the heart's own blood supply, is completely blocked, depriving the heart of oxygen and other nutrients. The longer this patient goes without treatment, the greater the damage to his heart muscle. Cardiologists have a saying for this: time is tissue. Mindful of every minute, DeVore transmits the EKG results to the hospital and alerts the ER team that the patient is on the way. They load him into the ambulance, where DeVore hooks up oxygen and starts an IV, while her partner gives him 4 80-milligram tablets of baby aspirin, and since his blood pressure is too high, nitroglycerin to relieve his chest pain. They head to the ER, and after a quick stop in a trauma room, a cardiac team whisks the patient to a specialized radiology room for a cardiac catheterization. Even though the EKG confirmed a bad heart attack, doctors still have to figure out which vessels are blocked and pinpoint wounded cardiac tissue. This procedure will allow the cardiologist to find out how bad the damage is and treat blockages in the coronary arteries fast. Getting patients to the cath lab, called door-to-balloon, in 90 minutes or less is critical. Oxygen-starved cells die off fast. Dead heart muscle from severe damage becomes scar tissue, so the heart pump will often fail to work well from that point forward if not treated quickly, says Nicholas Ruthman, a staff cardiologist at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. That's why, he says, we sometimes call the cath lab the table of truth. Once in the cath lab, the cardiologist, guided by X-ray, snakes a balloon-tipped catheter through a blood vessel, in this case in the patient's groin, up to the heart. A contrast dye is injected so the blockages will show up on a monitor. This image, called an angiogram, is currently the best way to find blocked vessels in the heart. The cardiologist inflates the balloon, which smashes the plaque against the walls of the coronary artery, sending much-needed blood to the heart. In an artery that's completely blocked, the cardiologist places a stent, a wire mesh that holds the artery open and keeps blood flowing to the heart. Most hospitals report back on patients whom paramedics bring to the ER to tell them whether the treatment was successful. And this time, our 57-year-old is going to be just fine. That is a fantastic part of our job, says DeVore, seeing how what we did actually made a difference in a heart attack. The plaque that builds up on the inner lining of our blood vessels, atherosclerotic plaque, is a byproduct of our body's best intentions. Our cells need lipids, or fats, but they don't dissolve in water. So, to travel through the bloodstream, they ball up into spheres called lipoproteins, tiny globes with cholesterol and triglycerides in the middle and proteins on the outside. But at some point, perhaps from microscopic damage to the inner vessel lining, the low-density versions of these lipoproteins, nicknamed bad cholesterol, which shuttle cholesterol through your arteries, can get trapped along with white blood cells and other molecules. Over decades, this gunk morphs into plaque with a crusty outer layer and a cheesy inner layer, eventually squeezing off blood flow and starving the heart of oxygen and nutrients. Today, more and more people are surviving heart attacks, over 90%, thanks in part to clot-busting drugs, angiograms, and cardiac care units. But these people still have damaged hearts, and ultimately, they still need more medical care. And despite the seemingly high survival rate, heart disease remains the leading cause of death for men and women. That's why healthcare professionals ask us to tackle controllable risk factors on our own. Hypertension, diabetes, sedentary lifestyle, stress, high body mass index, or weight to height ratio, BMI, and waist circumference, a touchy subject, says Christina Adams, an integrative cardiologist at Scripps Clinic in La Jolla, California, all contribute. Smoking ups the risk because chemicals from cigarettes narrow vessels by inflaming the cells that line them. And more recently, researchers have discovered that depression, lack of restorative sleep, and sleep apnea all contribute to heart disease. The risk escalates even more after stressful events, such as the death of a loved one or a job loss. Beyond that, there are disparities in risk based on where we live, our gender, and our racial and ethnic background. Black people and women are more likely to experience heart failure than white men of a similar age, and they're more likely to die from it, either in the hospital or within 5 years. Risk escalates for women post-menopause, and residents of the rural South are at a higher risk for heart attacks as well. Part of what ups these risks is air pollution and socioeconomic factors. Researchers have even found that zip codes are one of the best predictors for heart attack survival, a critical finding for minority and underserved communities. The disparities that drive treatment and survival rates are all the more worrisome because changes in diet and lifestyle can help prevent heart attacks, which are actually the endpoint of a very severe disease, says Adams. I like to empower people and say, look, You can do something about this every day. You have a chance to improve your health even in your 50s and 60s, even in your 70s. When it comes to maintaining a healthy lifestyle, we're our own worst enemies. Adam says it's typically obvious why patients have heart attacks, except to the patients themselves. They're in denial. Their response is often, "I can't believe this happened. I didn't have any symptoms. I'm healthy." In response, Adams is usually able to pull up electronic medical records and show them, for example, how their weight has increased 2 pounds every year for the past 5 years. She shows them years of unaddressed borderline high blood pressure and high triglycerides. For patients who do worry about their risk, Adams may suggest a coronary calcium scan, sometimes called mammography for the heart. These specialized scans can help assess risk by providing a three-dimensional reconstruction of the coronary arteries and a calcium score. The calcium-rich outer layer of buildup plaque lights up on the scan. Seeing the calcium on their arteries is often enough incentive to adopt preventative measures, says Adams. The coronary CT scans are helpful but limited because they don't show soft inner plaque. More recently, researchers have begun using the fat surrounding coronary arteries to scan for heart health. This perivascular fat lights up differently on a CT scan in areas where arteries are inflamed, which is where plaque tends to form. Results of a 2018 study published in The Lancet showed the fat could predict those at risk for dying of heart disease. Even if researchers keep finding new ways of pinpointing signals of heart disease at its earliest stages, though, people will still need to heed the call and change their lifestyles. Getting people to listen means reframing the message from cardiovascular disease to cardiovascular health, presenting heart disease as something preventable rather than as a problem that they must learn to live with, says Vasan Ramachandran, principal investigator and director of the Framingham Heart Study, a multi-generational study begun in 1948 at Boston University to find common contributing factors to heart disease. Ruthman says he takes a practical approach to encourage heart health. He asks patients to consider their prized possessions. You wouldn't be careless with a new diamond engagement ring, your grandfather's watch he wore all of his life, or a brand new car. No, you admire and take extra care of those things. Take care of your heart the same way, he says. It's truly something we can't live without. A dog's life. Scientists study aging in a new pet project. Matt Caberlin's search for the secret to a long life began in part with 560 unique strains of baker's yeast. He noticed that some of the strains with the greatest longevity tended to divide in slow motion, and he found that this slowdown, which takes place in the molecular mechanisms controlling cell division, could be tinkered with artificially by feeding the yeast a drug called rapamycin. As he began publishing his results in 2006, other researchers were finding that the drug, most commonly used to prevent rejection of organ transplants in humans, had a similar anti-aging effect in worms and flies. Several years later, a landmark paper in Nature showed that rapamycin could increase the lifespan of middle-aged mice by 9 to 14%. By then a professor of pathology at the University of Washington Medical School, Caberlin found these results both tantalizing and frustrating. There would appear to be molecular processes that are shared in the aging process across lots of different organisms, he says. That means, in theory, a chemical like rapamycin should therefore also prolong the lives of people. But it'd be hard to confirm. Humans live such a long time that it would take at least a generation to find out. What he required was a test subject that approximated humans biologically, but with a much shorter lifespan. An intriguing solution came up in 2011 in a conversation with biologist Daniel Promyslaw, who would soon become a new colleague and, like Caberlin, was a dog owner. Considering that canines have an average life expectancy of about a decade, everyday exposure to a human living environment, and natural susceptibility to many of the same frailties as humans, from heart disease to cancer, Promyslaw, who was already working towards starting aging studies in dogs, commented that pooches might just be a pathologist's best friend. And pathologists could return the favor by helping to extend pets' lifespans, a treat for anyone who has a dog. Caberlin decided to join in, launching the Dog Aging Project late last year with $23 million in funding from the National Institute on Aging, Promise Law and their colleagues got 80,000 responses to their call for canine volunteers. By then, their ambitions had expanded considerably. For most of his career, Promise Law had wondered why larger dogs live shorter lives. "It got me interested in thinking about dogs as a model for aging," he says. "Looking at the relationship between dog size and lifespan might be a way to find genes associated with diseases of aging and longevity." To address this question, Promise Law plans to observe dogs over their lifetimes. For the next decade, he'll collect genetic profiles, owner surveys, and data from veterinary checkups. According to Kate Creevy, a Texas A&M University veterinarian who co-leads the dog aging project with Promise Law and Caberlin, one of the biggest challenges will be to establish criteria to measure canine aging objectively, because nobody until now has set out to practice canine gerontology. "We need something more specific than for me to walk into an exam room and say, 'Gosh, your dog looks really good,'" says Creevy. Creevy and her colleagues are developing metrics that will encompass both physical and mental health, positioning them to investigate the genetics and environments of fast and slow agers, and to see whether similar systematic breakdowns make different breeds of dogs susceptible to different diseases. Caberlin's contribution to the Dog Aging Project directly complements the longitudinal study headed by Promise Law and Creevy. His working hypothesis is that rapamycin targets pathways that contribute to a variety of aging-related diseases. He explains, "If rapamycin delays the onset of cancer in golden retrievers and heart disease in Doberman pinschers, he says that he'll have clear evidence that there is a molecular biology of aging common to all canines and possibly other mammals." He has reason to be optimistic. He recently conducted a 10-week study on a couple of dozen middle-aged dogs, testing for side effects of rapamycin. In that brief period, he saw evidence of more youthful heart activity and more affectionate behavior, which might be interpretable as improved cognition. In an upcoming study, Caberlin will give rapamycin or a placebo to 500 middle-aged dogs for 3 years. Given their maturity, a couple hundred of the dogs will probably die in that period. By comparing the lifespan of dogs on the drug with those chewing on placebo, Caberlin will be able to determine whether this treatment really works. He acknowledges the personal disappointments ahead for some participants, but he believes the distress will be outweighed by the potential of prolonged life for dogs and humans alike. To a dog person like Caberlin, these extra years are a lot more enticing than spending some additional quality time with some long-lived baker's yeast. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slotke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.